Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. New York, this is Democracy Now!
The justice system needs to deal with the erosion of democracy. It is true in American history that if we don't deal with people who engage in election denialism and try to overthrow elections, that they'll do it again. And that's exactly what Fani Willis is trying to prevent here in Fulton County.
U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan has set a date of March 4th for Donald Trump's trial for plotting to overturn the 2020 election. We'll go to Georgia to speak with the co-founder of Black Voters Matters, as well as a law professor who was inside the Georgia courtroom when Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, testified Monday in an attempt to get his state trial moved to a federal court. Then to Jacksonville, Florida.
Our community is grappling to understand why this atrocity occurred. I urge us all not to look for sense in a senseless act of violence. There's no reason or explanation that we'll ever account for the shooter's decisions and actions. His sickening ideology is not representative of the values of this Jacksonville community that we all love so much.
Vigils are continuing in Jacksonville, Florida, after a white supremacist gunman fatally shot three black people at a dollar store Saturday. We'll get the latest and look back at another incident of racial violence in Jacksonville 63 years ago this week. Klansmen armed with wooded axe handles attacked peaceful civil rights activists who were trying to desegregate the city's lunch counters. The day became known as Axe Handle Saturday.
When you got down to Hemant Park, there were white males in Confederate uniforms handing out axe handles.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. is set March 4th, 2024, as the first day of former President Donald Trump's criminal trial for plotting to overturn the 2020 election. Trump's lawyers argued the trial should be delayed until April 2026. Instead, it's set to begin one day before Super Tuesday's presidential primaries. Meanwhile, Trump's former White House chief of staff, Mark Meadows, testified before a federal judge in Georgia Monday as part of an effort to move his trial from state court to federal court. Meadows is one of Trump's 18 co-defendants in the Georgia case. Arraignments for that case are scheduled for September 6th. We'll have more on the criminal legal cases against Trump and his allies after headlines. The University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill says a suspect has been arrested for fatally shooting a faculty member in a science building Monday. UNC officials have yet to identify the staffer who was killed or a possible motive in the shooting, which prompted a campus-wide lockdown that lasted for nearly 3 hours and prompted security alerts that disrupted classes at public schools on the first day of the school year throughout Chapel Hill. Meanwhile, in California, investigators say the gunman who killed three and wounded six others at a Southern California biker bar last week was a retired police sergeant who traveled from Ohio to confront his estranged wife. Former Ventura police officer John Snowling used three handguns and a shotgun during the massacre, all of which he purchased legally. Republican lawmakers in Tennessee have voted once again to silence State Representative Justin Jones, a black Democrat from Nashville, who was previously expelled from the House, then reelected to office this summer for leading protests against gun violence. On Monday, State Representative Jones was barred by Republicans from speaking for the remainder of the day after he made critical comments about a bill to bring more police officers into Tennessee schools. After protesters in the House gallery erupted into chants of fascists and racists, Republicans ordered state police to remove the public, including the parents of students who died from gun violence in the Covenant School shooting. This is State Representative Justin Jones speaking outside Tennessee's Capitol building just after he was silenced.
What we're seeing is this misapplication, this abuse of rules under the leadership of Speaker Cameron Sexton. Members of the public were taken out of the gallery. I was told I was going to be silent. Our caucus walked out in solidarity because what's happening is not democratic. It is authoritarianism. It's very troubling what we're witnessing here. You can see that the Capitol is surrounded, you know, by troopers. This does not look like a democratic body anymore.
Before he was silenced, State Representative Jones had been planning to force a vote of no confidence in the leadership of Cameron Sexton, the Speaker of the Tennessee House of Representatives. Justin Jones' interview with Democracy Now! You can see at democracynow.org on Monday. It was his 28th birthday. The leader of Sudan's military junta has ruled out a quick end to months of fighting, with the Rapid Support Forces condemning the rival paramilitary group as traitors in a speech to soldiers. General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan made the remarks Monday after the head of the RSF said he was open to a long-term ceasefire and talks to end Sudan's crisis. This comes as the United Nations warns of severe malnourishment among Sudan's children. A UN spokesperson said the fighting has internally displaced more than 3.6 million people, while nearly 1 million have fled across Sudan's borders.
The longer this fighting continues, the more devastating its impact is going to be. Hundreds of thousands of children are already severely malnourished and at imminent risk of death if left untreated. Millions more will have their education replaced by the devastating traumas of war, becoming a lost generation.
France's ambassador to Niger is defying an ultimatum from leaders of the military junta to leave his post within 48 hours. On Monday, French President Emmanuel Macron said from Paris that Niger's former colonial ruler would continue to support the deposed president, Mohamed Bazoum, and would support efforts by the regional bloc ECOWAS to restore him by force if necessary.
Our policy is simple. We do not recognize coup leaders. We support the president, who has not resigned, and we are committed to standing by his side. We support diplomatic efforts by ECOWAS and military action when it will be approved in the framework of partnership.
Guatemala's Supreme Electoral Tribunal has certified Bernardo Arevalo's victory in last week's presidential election runoff. Earlier Monday, a separate body ordered the suspension of Arevalo's progressive Semilla party, throwing the results into disarray as the party vowed to appeal its decision. Guatemala's Attorney General's office is investigating allegations of irregularities in Semilla's legal registration process, accusations Semilla and supporters say are part of an ongoing scheme by the Guatemalan corrupt business and political elite to discredit the democratic movement that propelled them into power. Arevalo received 60% of the vote, beating former First Lady Sandra Torres, who's backed by the right-wing elite. Arevalo has vowed to fight corruption and push for social reforms. His inauguration in Guatemala City alongside Vice President-elect Corina Herrera is scheduled for January 14th. Hurricane Idalia skirted the western coast of Cuba early this morning as it closed in on Florida's western coast, where it's expected to rapidly intensify ahead of its landfall Wednesday as a Category 3 storm with potentially life-threatening storm surges. Most of Florida's Gulf Coast remains under hurricane or tropical storm warnings, with evacuation orders issued for residents in low-lying areas of several counties, including the greater Tampa Bay region, which has avoided a direct hurricane impact for nearly a century. Idalia is expected to bring up to 12 feet of storm surge to Florida's Big Bend region. Four asylum seekers have died after the boat capsized off the Greek island of Lesbos Monday. There were 18 survivors taken into custody by Greek authorities, including refugees believed to be from Yemen, Palestine, and Somalia. The Biden administration's has known Saudi security forces were killing Ethiopian asylum seekers since at least last fall, but chose to keep quiet. That's according to the New York Times, which reports United Nations officials last year presented the U.S. with information about Saudi border guards shooting Ethiopian asylum seekers, including women and children. The gruesome abuse was exposed by a Human Rights Watch report earlier this month, which documented how hundreds and possibly thousands of asylum seekers have been killed. The group said Saudi authorities fired machine guns and explosive weapons at asylum seekers who were fleeing human rights abuses in Ethiopia's Tigray region and attempted to cross the Yemen-Saudi border. Guards also executed people at close range. The report cited firsthand accounts from 42 Ethiopian asylum seekers, over 100 verified videos and photos, and analysis of satellite imagery between 2021 and this year. The Biden administration has not publicly criticized Saudi Arabia, a close ally, for the killings. To see our coverage, go to democracynow.org. A young Palestinian man has died of his wounds nearly 2 months after he was shot in the head during an Israeli army raid in the occupied West Bank. 20-year-old Ezzedine Kanan was from the town of Jabah outside the city of Jenin. He's one of at least 172 Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since the start of the year. Human Rights Watch warns last year was the deadliest year for Palestinian children in the West Bank in 15 years, and this year is on track to meet or exceed last year's levels. Human Rights Watch added in a statement, quote, unless Israel's allies, particularly the United States, pressure Israel to change course, more Palestinian children will be killed, unquote. U.S. Commerce Secretary Gina Raimondo is in China for a four-day visit aimed at reducing tensions over Taiwan. Speaking from Beijing after a meeting with her counterpart on Monday, Raimondo said the Biden administration wants to maintain a stable economic relationship with China and more than $700 billion of mutual trade between the U.S. and China.
The vast majority of our trade and investment relationship does not involve national security concerns. And in this regard, I'm committed to promoting trade and investment in those areas that are in our mutual best interest.
And in Colorado, the city of Denver's reached a $4.7 million settlement with more than 300 Black Lives Matter activists who were brutally arrested by police in the summer of 2020. The settlement was unanimously approved by the Denver City Council, siding with protesters who said police violated their First Amendment rights. The class action lawsuit accused Denver police of using violent tactics against hundreds of protesters to enforce a curfew enacted in response to the massive racial justice actions following the police murder of George Floyd in Minnesota. Protesters described Denver police firing tear gas, flashbang grenades, pepper balls, rubber bullets, and other projectiles without giving them any time to disperse. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Coming up, we look at the trials of Donald Trump. Stay with us.
One thing you have to agree with me, and that is for sure, and that is for sure, nobody can live forever, and everybody is the same. There we go. How we doing, man? What's happening? All right. Yeah, 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 yeah. Sooner or later, you're going to understand that. There we go. Nobody can live forever. Nobody will know how I feel.
Nobody Can Live Forever by Tim Maia. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The federal trial of Donald Trump for plotting to overturn the 2020 election is now set to begin in Washington, D.C. on March 4th, 2024. One day before the Super Tuesday presidential primaries. District Judge Tanya Chutkan selected the date on Monday. Trump's legal team had asked for the trial to be delayed until 2026, while special counsel Jack Smith had proposed January 2024 start date. In making their case for delaying the trial, Trump's legal team cited the 1931 case of the Scottsboro Boys, A group of black teenagers who were quickly tried and convicted after being falsely accused of raping a white woman. The Supreme Court eventually reversed their convictions. Judge Chutkan rejected the argument, saying Trump's case is, quote, profoundly different. She wrote, quote, I have seen many cases unduly delayed because a defendant lacks adequate representation. This is not the case here, she said. Meanwhile, in a separate case, former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows testified before a federal judge in Georgia Monday as part of an effort to move his state trial from state to federal court. Meadows is one of Trump's 18 co-defendants in the Georgia case. Arraignments for that case are scheduled for September 6th. We go now to Atlanta, where we're joined by two guests. Cliff Albright is co-founder and executive director of Black Voters Matter. Anthony Michael Kreis is an assistant professor of law at Georgia State University. He was in the courtroom Monday where Mark Meadows testified. Let's begin there, Professor Kreis. You were in the courtroom. Talk about what Mark Meadows is arguing for, going to moving the case to a federal court, and the surprise that he himself testified for hours, what exactly he said and what's now on the record that can be used against him in the trial.
So Mark Meadows really wants to get his case removed and tried, not in Fulton County State Court, but he wants it in federal court, partially because the jury pool might be more favorable for him, and because I think that there's an expectation that federal rules of procedure might be more favorable. And so Mark Meadows essentially has to show that he was acting at least plausibly within the scope of his employment as chief of staff to President Trump, and that's why he's entitled to this removal. So there was a lot of debate and discussion about whether the actions he was taking in Georgia were consistent with his job, consistent with a federal interest that would warrant removal. And he gave a lot of very general explanations that weren't particularly persuasive. What was somewhat surprising was the fact that he testified because he is under criminal indictment. So he was open to cross-examination in addition to the testimony he provided on direct examination. And the big thing that I think we should kind of focus on here is he had very few answers for some of the issues and the evidence that the DA proffered that showed he was working with the campaign as chief of staff, which is unlawful under the Hatch Act, which is a federal law that says federal employees can't engage in election, partisan electioneering. So, for example, he didn't have a really good answer for why he offered to help get the assistance of Trump campaign funds to engage in an audit of ballots here in Fulton County. He didn't have a particularly good explanation of why he was coordinating the fake elector scheme and the phone call between Brad Raffensperger and Donald Trump through election campaign officials. And he had really no answer for why, if he thought this was really about the federal government ensuring free and fair elections here in Georgia, that he never roped in or read into his calls people from the Department of Justice or the Department of Homeland Security. So I think that he really had a very bad day. The threshold, to be clear, is pretty low to bring a case into federal court from state court for those who have been former federal employees. But I do think he had a rough time on the stand.
And Professor Kreis, what was your sense of how the judge was reacting to his testimony in particular and her disposition to potentially move the case to federal court?
Well, I think that there's a couple of truths here. First is Mark Meadows is a pretty affable guy. So in terms of his testimony, he seemed in some degree cooperative. He seemed quite likable, which is great if you want to put your client on the stand. I think that's partially why he was put on the stand, is because he has a pretty decent personality, and I think that came across. However, at the same time, there were a number of moments moments where he seemed to be evasive or seemed to give answers that droned on in order to avoid answering the question that the Fulton County DA's office posed to him. So I think the judge a number of times redirected Mark Meadows to provide more direct, clearer answers that really spoke to what the Fulton DA was trying to ask. And that's, of course, not a particularly great thing, right? Because the judge ultimately has to decide whether a witness is credible in deciding these kinds of questions. So, I think in some respects, his testimony was a mixed bag. He came across, again, as being somewhat cooperative and easygoing and, pretty, his demeanor was generally good for a defendant in his situation. But at the same time, I think the judge was skeptical of his evasiveness.
And there will be at least some of the defendants who will have a speedier trial later this year, including Kenneth Chesebrough. What's your sense of the implications of this for Trump himself, that in essence that the prosecution will have to put much of its case in that trial ahead of time so that the Trump defense team, when he does come to trial, will have a pretty good sense of all of the strategy of the prosecution?
Well, I think it's a double-edged sword. So the first threshold issue, though, is that Judge Scott McAfee will be the one who decides when these trials occur. So it isn't necessarily a given that Donald Trump will be tried separately from the individuals who've asked for a speedy trial. So that's kind of a threshold question we don't really have an answer to. But in the event that these are severed, the double-edged sword is basically this. On the one hand, Donald Trump's team will get a taste of what the evidence is that hasn't been publicly released, how the prosecutor will approach this, and will find ways perhaps to poke holes in evidence when it comes time for Donald Trump to come to trial. On the other hand, the same thing is true of the DA. The DA can learn what kinds of arguments might work better or may not work so well against Donald Trump, and this could be a test trial. But the real danger for Donald Trump is the fact that when you have a number of defendants proceeding earlier, the likelihood is that there will be one or maybe more who will give evidence inadvertently that incriminates Donald Trump. They'll point fingers at Donald Trump or other people who are higher up in the food chain. And there's also the potential for some of these defendants to strike deals. And I think it's really, really unlikely that Fani Willis, the district attorney here in Fulton County, will allow people to engage in plea deals that either give some fairly light sentences or just essentially a slap on the wrist without fundamentally admitting that they engaged in an unlawful racketeering scheme. And that could be very dangerous for Donald Trump, too. So I think it really cuts in two different ways. There's a lot of variables here that we still have to sort through here in Fulton County, right? Whether these cases will be in state court versus federal court, when the trials will occur. Are there co-defendants who are currently engaged in negotiations to turn state's evidence for the prosecution's benefit? So there's a lot of open-ended questions that remain.
I want to bring Cliff Albright into this conversation, co-founder and executive director of Black Voters Matter. Can you once again frame this as a voting rights issue, as a massive violation of voting rights in Georgia, this RICO case that's been brought against the president of the United States, his chief of staff, what they did in your state of Georgia?
Yeah, thanks, Amy. To be clear, we have to be honest that what Trump was attacking, what this entire conspiracy, because we should all be very clear, wasn't just Trump, right? At least 19 co-conspirators, even more that are unindicted at this point. But what they were attacking wasn't even necessarily all voters of Georgia. I mean, in the big picture, it was all voters. It was the entire country. But they were specifically going after Black voters, right? They were specifically upset about Fulton County voters, right? The same way that they were upset about Pennsylvania, but they were really upset about Philadelphia, the same way they were upset about Michigan, but they were really upset just about Detroit. And so, this attack on voters overall, but in particular targeted at black voters, we can't underestimate the scale of it. Even if we look at one aspect of it, the until recently underreported aspect of the Coffee County break-in, the breach in the security systems. Again, this is a county which had a history of suppressing black votes, of attacking black activists like Olivia Coley Pearson, who, by the way, Raffensperger, Secretary of State, and GBI spent more time and resources investigating one woman, Olivia Pearson, in Coffee County, just for helping people, illiterate voters, to be able to vote, than they have spent investigating the Coffee County breach, right? And so all of this we have got to put in the context of the wider suppression of black votes and a wider risk to our voting systems and to this entire democracy. What happens in one county or in one state could, in fact, jeopardize the entire nation.
Can you talk, Cliff Albright, about what's happening at two levels with an attack on Fannie Willis herself, the Fulton County DA? You have the beginning of this legal battle between Georgia Republicans and Willis as they may potentially try to remove her from office using Senate Bill 92. The law signed by Governor Brian Kemp states that a prosecutor can be removed for, quote, conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice, which brings the office into disrepute. Can you talk about that? And most recently, Ohio Congressman Jim Jordan, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, right, the U.S. Congress, announcing he's opening an inquiry into Willis, questioning whether she had collaborated with the Biden administration in targeting any federal funding her office receives. So she'll be taking on these investigations at the same time she's bringing this RICO conspiracy case against the 19, including the former president.
Yeah, and of course, you've got those two threats, which are, you know, legal and administrative threats. But then you've also got the other threats that we also know about, right? The physical threats, the intimidation, the threats of violence, which is a whole nother story. But just in terms of like those two political threats, you know, you'd like to not even take the Jim Jordan threat seriously. I mean, he's trying to, you know, threatening to subpoena her. What we know is that that's not going to go anywhere. She's under no obligation to respond to that. But what we also know is that to a certain extent, not only is he trying to protect Trump, he's possibly even trying to protect himself. You know, he's been kind of implicated in some of these overall conspiracy, not the actual charges that have been filed, but just in terms of his overall involvement in this plan and some of the White House meetings and so on and so forth. The far more serious one, though, other than the federal one that Jordan is leading, is the state version, which at the time we all knew, many of us, including myself, warned that this was being targeted directly at Fannie Willis. It was also being directed at other DAs that, you know, Republicans in the state feel aren't being, quote unquote, tough on crime, that they're not enforcing, the harshest sentences, that they're not enforcing or going aggressively after you know, marijuana cases. Also, has been targeted at DAs that have said that they wouldn't be aggressive in enforcing abortion rules and laws. That goes for Georgia as well as Florida as well as elsewhere. But when Georgia in particular announced this law and went after it, what we knew was that they had Fannie Willis squarely in their targets. And that's exactly what we're seeing, right? And so we could very well see a situation where this state, where, by the way, Trump, as you've reported on, Trump cannot receive a pardon from the governor in this state. So the only way for them to really derail this is to derail the actual charges and the actual litigation. And that's what they're trying to do by threatening Fannie Willis. It's important because it speaks to a point that I've said several times. There's more than one way to overturn an election, right? The Trump investigation is one way that they tried to overturn an election. But we are seeing time and time again with DAs, with mayors, with city councils, with legislators, as you just talked about earlier in the show in terms of Tennessee, that they are finding ways to overturn elections by simply removing people from offices, DAs and others, restricting their jurisdiction so that they don't get to control as much territory. See Jackson, Mississippi, right? Creating a whole new jurisdiction, or in some cases, simply limiting their powers to be able to investigate or take certain actions and preempting certain laws. There's more than one way to overturn an election, and black voters and black communities have been experiencing this long before Trump stepped on the scene.
And Cliff Albright, I'd like to go back to something you mentioned earlier, the Coffee County incident that is one of the central parts of this RICO indictment. Could you, for those people who are not aware, talk more specifically about what is alleged that happened in Coffee County on the part of some of the Trump supporters and campaign folks?
Yeah, it's a great question because it's a complicated piece of the puzzle that a lot of people really still don't understand. I want to give a shout out to Marilyn Marks, Coalition for Good Governance, that did a lot of great work. A lot of people wouldn't know, the country wouldn't know what happened in Coffee County if not for litigation and activism that was already taking place in that county, even before some of these federal investigations and state investigations started. But to put simply, what happened was that you had local officials in Coffee County who allegedly gave an invite to certain Trump-related agents, including, of all people, cyber ninjas that many of us know of in Arizona, but gave invites for them to come in and inspect the computer systems and the softwares and the voter information in Coffee County. We know that officials from the Secretary of State's office